Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on whose land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a big shout out to everybody around the continent that is taking our program via the National Indigenous Radio Service NIRS, or if you're tuning in via our app, 98.9 FM, for the best country, which you can download for free from your app store, so please do so. Or if you're tuning in via our website, 98.9fm.com.au, please tune in via our website, because through our website, this program is put up as a podcast, so you can catch it there, and also previous Let's Talk programs. You can also catch us on Apple Podcasts and also Spotify. You can stream us through those platforms, and those platforms beaming us into your communities. And as always, it is great to have your company. Joining me on the program this morning, I speak with the front man from Chasing Ghost, Thungari Man from New South Wales. And I have a chat to him about, you know, what spurred this conversation off really was our love of history and also his latest single called Summer. And I caught up with him this morning here on Let's Talk. On Let's Talk now is Jimmy Kyle from Chasing Ghosts. Brother Jimmy, just before we go any further, could I get you to tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from, please?
Yeah, my name's Jimmy Kyle. I'm a proud Thungari man from the mid-north coast of New South Wales near Bellbrook. At a place called Bilibian Creek is where I grew up, where my family's from. Yeah, that's me, brother.
You've released a song called Summer. Mm-hmm. We've been chatting online for a bit now in regards to your music and the story that you're telling. And I guess that's what really caught my attention. As the listeners here on Let's Talk will know, I always love to talk about history on Let's Talk. Well, I've got to revive it, Let's Talk History. And we just sort of talk about different sections of time in Australian history where Aboriginal people have done and continue to do amazing things and just be deadly like we are. Brother, your song Summer is an amazing song. The film clip in itself is amazing. The story that it tells itself with the film clip as well. But Summer, you're talking about a very heavy topic, and a topic that, I don't know if it's hard not to say that it's something that has an effect nearly every Aboriginal person or nation in this country. We're coming to a time in our history now where it's starting to be well aware of the true history. Academics for the last 20, maybe 30 years have been non-Indigenous and Indigenous have been recording this history in books, in papers, just doing research. Our mob have always told these stories through music, through the 70s and especially the 80s. Our music really pushed our movement and our people in a certain direction. And even nowadays, we see more people using their music, especially a lot of younger artists using their music to amplify the struggle of our mob. Brother, your song Summer talks about a massacre. And like I said before, and correct me if you think I'm wrong as well, like, is that something that you could say most likely has affected most Aboriginal people here around Australia?
Well, it's probably in different ways for different people. You know, one of the things when it comes to massacres, retrospectively looking back, is the first thing, I guess, is having a different narrative to the rest of society. You're aware of something that the majority of society isn't aware of. So your worldview changes. For example, you know, if you were to look at the predominant narrative in white societies, or you know, societies that have large numbers of people of European descent, they're often framed up as the bringers of peace, the bringers of democracy, civilized, highly educated, sophisticated, cultural, religious kind of societies that have advanced technology. And that sort of self-promoted myth, I think, plays to people never having to really think about themselves as white people in a different narrative. So I think if you're born into that, where you know the curriculum, if you're a white person, and the curriculum says, you know, these are all the great things that occurred, and these are the great things that we've done, and we're very sophisticated, and that's a vastly different narrative to an Aboriginal kid sitting in that same class, hearing that same thing, saying, "Well, hang on a minute, you know, this narrative in a school says that Europeans came and it was a peaceful settlement." Well, immediately that kid knows something's wrong with that story, because that's not true. You know, and then sort of, oh, it was a sophisticated, intelligent, you know, chivalrous society that was, you know, of English nobles and gentlemen. And immediately that black kid knows that's not true. And then it's, well, that, you know, they were the bringers of peace, culture and democracy. And immediately, again, that Aboriginal kid sits in that class and knows that's not true. So immediately the kid becomes aware that the institutions that dominate a big part of your childhood do two things. They reinforce the status quo, and they don't tell the truth. They tell a narrative that supports the status quo. So I think massacres do affect every Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person in contemporary society, especially if you're aware of them, simply because they provide the counter-narrative to what Australians are generally taught in class. So this, you know, this sort of scrappy underdog, you know, she'll be right, mate, true blue Aussie narrative. Oh, it's terrific. And I'd love to believe it. You know, I love the illusion and the myth as much as anyone else. But if you don't have any sort of cognitive dissonance on this subject, if you're aware of the actual history, which most Aboriginal people are, that's just a fabricated myth. And sometimes when we talk to these subjects, what happens is we take that illusion away from people. We burst that illusion, and that's where some of that resentment towards blackfellas comes, is don't take my myth, don't take my narrative. You know, don't tell me the truth, tell me what's comfortable, tell me what's easy, tell me what justifies what I have. So I think for, you know, for blackfellas, it does affect us, because immediately we recognise very, very young that the institutions, especially the educational institutions, have massive gaps in their truth telling, and in place of those gaps, they've been filled in with nostalgic myths about Mother England and the Commonwealth, and sort of this supposed civilized society that came here and we were the primitive ones. I couldn't think of anything more backwards if I tried. You know, I think you'd only have to look at how many countries England invaded. I think roughly there's 205 countries on the planet. And all bar 22 of those countries were invaded by England.
And was talking off air as well about the amount of massacres that are in close proximity to each other that may and most likely be sort of connected linked to the people who'd done these massacres, and sort of what their locations are sort of known today. Most of the times these massacres happen on the side of a highway that we're driving through, or it's like at a resort on an island, or it's at a swimming hole where we travel, where people holiday to and stuff as well. Like, it's just... Yeah, like that. I just wanted to sort of, you know, touch on that as well, and sort of bring that to this conversation as well, because we was having a yarn off air about that as well.
Mm. Well, as for Rottnest, I think about 4,400 or as well over 4,000 people were taken in chains to Rottnest. I would imagine probably Yamaji people and different clanal groups of the broader Noongar nation.
Mm.
I think Rottnest might actually be under Noongar Boodja. I think that's their country, perhaps. I could be wrong on that. I'd be interested if anyone knows that specifically, but I know... You know, the 4,000 odd people that went there and the many that died, you know, children as young as 10 years old in neck chains. I just couldn't imagine a country in Europe, for example, such as, let's say, Germany or Poland, or, you know, let's say we're talking about something like Auschwitz, or and then to sort of put up a commercial enterprise. Put it up on the land of where there's been such an atrocity occur. To me, that smacks of disrespect. It smacks of denialism. It talks very heavily to what I've seen Western Australia do time and time and time again, which is denialism. And I think it works to the financial advantage of many people that are not Aboriginal. And so therefore those stories get buried. As to the conversation around, you know, massacres around Australia in general, I would imagine most waterholes and most creeks and rivers, one being a source of transport, obviously the source of life, mob were never too far from a water source. You know, all the animals, whether they're domesticated, you know, imported animals or whether they're native animals, everything requires water, and we are the driest continent on the planet. So many of those massacres occur along waterways, and, you know, it's the Mile Creek massacre, for example, you know, like that's it's the Lower Tau Creek massacre. There's, you know, often there's massacres on stations and places like that, but there's so many along our waterways because that's the source of life for everyone. And that's, I guess, at some point where people were going to rub against other cultures. I just feel, Bo, you know, in a contemporary society, these things for the majority of Australians seem in the very distant past. These things seem abstract and perhaps not relevant to today. But if we were to have a look at the impact, we've got massacres in Australia, as you know, and as most Aboriginal people listening know, occurring in, 1926 in Western Australia, 1928 in the Northern Territory. And these massacres are being committed by well-known figures in Australian history, people of power, of privilege, of status. These aren't some, you know, hillbillies that are squatting in the country that are poor people. These are people with state-sanctioned or Commonwealth-sanctioned rights and ability to basically use as much lethal force as necessary, as required, to steal the land off its original people. So these massacres, many of these massacres are occurring after World War I up to World War II. And when you consider that the amount of Aboriginal soldiers in World War One and then again in World War Two is, you know, there's 1,000 Aboriginal Anzac diggers that gave their life in the Great War, and then another 2,000 gave their lives in World War Two. That's more than all the Europeans since World War Two. In Korea, Vietnam, Malaya, Borneo, East Timor, Afghanistan, Iraq, Desert Storm. We gave more lives in those two conflicts than all the Europeans since. So at that same time, if you were to go to any country town in Australia, you could find a cairn or a memorial or some sort of dedication to both of those conflicts. You would find it in any single town. But yet you can't find many markers or cairns or monuments that reflect the massacres in the frontier wars. And so there's this notion that, you know, it happened 230 years ago, when in reality it happened closer to, you know, our grandparents' lifetimes, or great-grandparents' lifetimes. This is not so far away. This is not that far removed. And for me, what I guess what I consider is, how would people in mainstream Australia, you know, that continue to tell us, you've got to move on? It's like, well, move on to where? We're walking on the country, you know, we're walking on where our ancestors, where their blood spilt. Like, where do we move on to? How do we move on when it's not acknowledged? And it's not, you know, it's not being told straight. If I was to knock down all those Anzac memorials in every country town and get rid of them, there'd be, you know, non-Indigenous people up in arms. They'd lose their minds.
And not to mention, when we look at the people carrying out these massacres, and like you mentioned, like, these are just not partials or squatters. You know, these are usually military-trained people who then train the squatters how to use rifles, how to tactic, how to sort of, you know, I guess, how to shoot, but then also how to sort of tactically track or surround people and kill them as well. One story that I just wanted to mention, when you mentioned one of those last massacres, Coniston Massacre was actually, you know, one of the perpetrators of that was a veteran from maybe World War One or Two, you know, Constable George Murray.
Yeah, World War One.
World War One, and he's actually quoted saying, you know, I killed traditional Aboriginals.
Absolutely.
Mm.
And Constable George Stanley Murray, I think his full name is. He was. This is the guy that started the first, what was the original Northern Territory Police. So, you know, it's less than 100 years ago. This is 1928, so it's, you know, 100 and... I'm trying to do the math, and it's a bit early, but it's, you know, it's 2021, so years, it's,
yeah, 90.
Something like that, 92, 93 years, something to that effect. You know, so it's not that far ago, and it's the police. It's the leader of the police who recently, ABC, like, you know, in the last month, did a sort of whole, I think it was the anniversary of the Northern Territory Police. And they did this whole thing on Constable John Stanley Murray. And right at the very end, there was this tiny sort of little disclaimer at the end. And he also was responsible for the Coniston Station Massacre. And it was just so quickly brushed over. It's like, hang on a minute. So this reflects the relationship that the institutions that non-Indigenous people get support from are the same institutions historically that have absolutely always disenfranchised us. And a lot of non-Indigenous people can't quite understand that, because their experience with police is, well, when you're scared, when there's a problem, when there's a criminal, when you need protection, you ring the police. Our experience is, we're the problem, we're the criminal. For God's sakes, don't ever ring the police, because that will be the assumption immediately, and justice will be dealt in the most brutal ways possible. So in that same state, less than 100 years ago, 90-odd years ago, the head of the police force is openly committing murder, is openly breaking his own rules and committing murder on people. And, you know, quite a large number of people. Like, I think if people try and comprehend what the Christchurch massacre did to New Zealand, what the Port Arthur massacre did to Australia, well, what do they think these massacres did to us? And this isn't a lone neo-Nazi who's gone become an extremist or a man with schizophrenia. This is someone in the hierarchy who has the legal clout and the credibility and represents the crown. This is a person that people should have been able to seek justice from, but instead he breaks his own laws, and because he doesn't see us as human. He doesn't see human beings. He doesn't see that what he sees is, you know, this is also the period of the, you know, this is during the period of the trade was stopped with the Trepangers, with the Makassans, the Immigration Restriction Act of 1901, aka the White Australia Policy. You know, that's all behind that same backdrop. We've still got slavery occurring at this point and indentured servitude.
Removal policies, you know.
Assimilation policies. And, you know, so this kind of, this cognitive dissonance that white Australia has with understanding, well, I'm sorry, but in this case, you are not the good guys in this story. You are not the heroes that saved the day. You are the, you know, these people are the perpetrators of something that anyone else around the world seems to be able to comprehend. But internally, the denialism we've created in this country by indoctrinating children from a young age to believe nothing's occurred. I had a Māori guy only a couple of days ago say to me, oh, would you consider these skirmishes or a full-fledged war, talking about the frontier wars from sort of roughly 1820 through to 1860. And I said, well, it depends. Do you consider the Māori-Anglo land wars a skirmish? And he said, well, it's a fact that we defended our country. And I just thought, even Indigenous people from other nations have been so caught up in this European narrative that they think they're the only people that would have defended their lands. And it's like, well, I would imagine Native Americans in Canada and in America would have defended their lands just like we did, of course.
If you are just tuning in to Let's Talk, I'm having a chat to Brother Jimmy Kyle from Chasing Ghost. We've been chatting about massacres and frontier conflict. And one of the things that sort of spurred this conversation up between us was his latest single, which is Summer. And we're going to play that now here on 98.9 FM.
He pointed to the edge of the river with a hand still shaking. That's where the nightmare came. Begin to run, naked now, quickly to the tops of the trees. They shot them down like Legion Order. So I go there in the summer, to pay my respects. But there's no headstone, it wears out unless we forget. I'm reminded in summer, with a flag around your neck. That I was, and it always will be. The gunshots echo. this summer, we can pay our respects. And there's no guilt, bro, although you might need to jump the fence. And it's not for me to forgive. God knows we can't forget. That it was, and it always will be. That it was, and it always will be. That it was, and it always will be.
And you're back on Let's Talk. That was Summer by Chasing Ghost. Brother Kyle, tell us a bit about the song. This first half of our yarn, you can pretty much tell what inspired or spurred, you know, these conversations on was the initial introduction to ourselves was through your song. Mm-hmm. I guess in a way we've broadly spoken about sort of what driven you to write this song, but in your own words and for our listeners, just tell us a bit of background about that song.
Well, the song's written about a massacre called the Tau Creek Massacre, which was in 1856. It happened in close proximity to two other quite well-known massacres in our community, one being the Kundurang Station Massacre and the other being the PD Creek Massacre. Now, those massacres occurred not too far west of a place called Bellbrook on the Armidale Road in the Macleay Valley on the mid-north coast of New South Wales in Thungari country. And 1856, so this is just before the period of the gold rush and around that sort of getting to close to that time and before, just prior to Ned Kelly's sort of rise, I guess, to give people an idea of what Australia is looking like. There's still redcoat soldiers in the country. The frontier wars have been raging. It's sort of coming towards the end of the bulk of the heavy fighting. And there was a young boy found in the pile of bodies. So what had happened was two men had spent the night boiling down lead bullets to put in their muzzle-loaded rifles, and an Aboriginal man called Jimmy Taylor, which has a bridge named after him in the area, Jimmy Taylor could speak a bit of English, and he cottoned on to what was happening, and he told the mob, you better take off, they're coming. And it was a reprisal attack linked back to the PD Creek Station Massacre. And they were planning on wiping out everyone they could. So the militia were getting ready the next day. Two squatters had been making these bullets and loading up their guns. And the mob had taken off up the Armidale, up the Macleay River, heading towards Dorigo and Armidale, going to go up towards Unawan country. And those who were Binjul and, you know, and the old nooka, old grandmothers and that, the old mothers, they, anyone who was sort of not able-bodied, I guess, or athletically inclined to get away fast, they decided they would hide up in Lower Tau Creek. That would be, so the group split into two and everyone else moved on forward, and this mob split into Lower Tau Creek. And when they got to Tau Creek, they climbed up the trees and hid in the vines. It was so thick at the time, they were sort of were matted vines in the canopy, and they climbed up there and they were resting up there hiding. Anyway, they eventually, the militia, I'd imagine using dogs, but they were tracked down eventually. And every single person was shot out of the trees. And we're talking very large numbers of people into double and triple figured death totals. So they shot everyone out of the trees. Someone, as the story goes, that someone had either coughed or made a noise, but it gave away their location. And as people were falling from the trees, lo and behold, somehow one child survived. And that child was found in a pile of bodies, sucking on his dead mother's breast, still alive. So she'd broken the fall. She'd taken the fall to save her baby, by the sounds of it. And so a white fella named Hurdley Scott, he's only 22 years old, he heard the gunshots. And Hurdley Scott took off on his horse, and he followed up the river and come across the pile of bodies. And as he went through the bodies, you know, he was horrified, but he found this young child, and he put the child up on his horse and raised him up as his own. And that man became Jack Scott, or as we would say back home, Bubbang, which is grandfather, and Bubba for short. But Bubba Jack Scott was the sole survivor of the Lower Tower Creek Massacre. And he became kind of a legendary stockman in the district. And Bubba Jack, he would end up living with my great-grandfather. They were living together, and he would name his daughter Nan Chick after my grandmother. And I didn't know any of these things growing up. It would be, I would sort of be a teenager before I'd find these things out. And so when, you know, that story was, I'd heard it from so many different perspectives. And growing up, it was a story, but I never ever learned it at school. It was never written down from a European education system of any sort. It was just things I'd learned around a coffee table until many, many years later when I was given the cold, hard facts of what had occurred and who was involved from our mob.
Yeah.
And it was quite well documented from our mob.
And then how do you sort of put that into a song? Massacres are as raw as it can get as well, and you didn't shy back from telling that as well. But how do you articulate it into a song for people to visualize what has happened as well? And, like, I think the film clip is very interesting as well, brother. So for the listeners, if you could talk to that part as well.
Well, so in short, it is a challenge. It's a challenge because I've got a very large white a white audience, and many of my fans are non-Indigenous people. And so how do I tell that story in a way that stays true to the mob, stays true to our history, and doesn't alienate a listener, but does bring the truth? And you know, Bo, it's what our old people have always said, is just tell it straight. So I just told the story. I never told people what to think about the story. I never told them how to feel about the story. I just told them the story. And I went back, actually, and I listened to an album by Johnny Cash called Bitter Tears, which was an album sort of dedicated to the struggle that Native Americans had against colonial forces there and American forces. And the way that he did that narrative of just storytelling, telling the story straight, and the listener naturally can't help but empathize. When you take the guilt out, when you take the blame out, when you take the defensiveness out, when you take the denialism out, when you just tell the story, the average human being will empathize with the scenario. So that was how I tried to approach the story. It was very challenging. It was very scary. I told Rolling Stone, you know, I was very scared to write these songs because it is challenging, and it's such a delicate balance. And I wanted to make sure I honored the story and honored my mob. And I thought, well, if they're not going to put it in the school books, I'll put it on the radio. That's how I'll get around that. You know, that's what we've always done, is found ways to get around it. And for the film clip was this challenging the contemporary narrative in Australia, which was basically a face-off between a young non-Indigenous guy with the Australian flag around his neck and an Aboriginal elder who was decloaking colonialism and painting up for ceremony. And he sort of decloaks this white nationalism that we're seeing a resurgence of, you know, recently we've seen it at the Grampians with neo-Nazis lighting, you know, crosses and standing on the Grampians and all this sort of vitriol, which has come out of this push of white nationalism ever since the Howard years. So it was sort of a commentary in the film clip to say, you don't need to pretend you're in Europe. You don't need white nationalism, white Australia. There is a culture here. There is a history here. You live in a black country. Yes, we have a large white migrant population, but we are not in Europe. It's a different circumstance. We're in the black part of the world, and you are welcome to come and learn. If you have a pure heart and a good intention, you are welcome to come and learn. You are welcome to join in. You are welcome to celebrate Aboriginal culture. We don't discriminate like that. We've always accepted people from other mobs, whether they were Chinese or Europeans. 80% of Aboriginal marriages are interracial. You know, we're not discriminating. But we can't compromise the truth either. So that's where, you know, the resolution in the film clip, and people, if you want to check it out, you can jump on YouTube and look at Chasing Ghost Summer. The resolve in that film clip is this young Anglo-Australian kid, you know, taking the flag off the neck, that sort of Cronulla riots imagery that we've seen, taking that off the neck and painting up with Uncle John and dancing and learning, you know, sort of a variation of shake a leg, like a, you know, and sort of learning that mosquito dance rather, but sort of learning those dances. And when we actually shot the film clip, the young actor who played the non-Indigenous guy, Joe Maloney, amazing actor, he himself went through this massive shift in his mind. He felt so honoured to be a part of it, to do the truth telling, but he just felt so embraced by Aboriginal culture and so appreciative that he could be a part of it. And you know, we love sharing our culture. We're proud of what we've shared. So this film clip sort of comes back to reconciliation, which is regardless of our history. You know, this will always be Aboriginal land, but it is the homes of many people now. And we do have to find a relationship that is conducive to moving forward into the future, because we are stronger together. But we must do that in a way that has integrity. And this sort of film clip and the song challenges all of these notions. I suggest for people to make their own minds up. You can, you know, form your own opinion and have a look. Again, that's just Chasing Ghosts Summer on YouTube. Go have a look and you know, share your thoughts. But we ultimately, if we think about our kids and our grandkids and our great-grandkids, we need to have a relationship with everyone in this country, but it needs to be on equal footing, on equal terms, and with honesty and truth and a real awareness of that we are the survivors of an invasion. We are the survivors of human rights abuses. We are the survivors of some of the most barbaric behaviour that occurred in the British Empire. And we're the descendants of those people who were lucky enough to survive, or resilient enough to survive, I should say.
Is it something that the first song that you've sort of done when delving into the history of this country?
So under different projects when I was a lot younger, I actually sung quite a lot about things like the Black War in Tasmania, the removal of Aboriginal children, Maralinga, the bomb testing site, where, you know, Aboriginal people weren't removed from where they were testing atom bombs in South Australia and other parts of Australia. I think people aren't aware of how much atomic testing occurred in Australia. Like, I think it's over 28 explosions or detonations that occurred. So I sung about a lot of those things when I was a lot younger, and then moved through different paths and journeys and wrote about different things. And then on this EP, the Homelands EP, that's coming out in May, actually my band, which is, you know, a bunch of white dudes who are my best mates. They're, you know, some of my best mates. They're terrific, supportive, loving, kind, and curious rather than judgmental. You know, they want to understand. And they see the injustice. And they said to me, you know, this is, you teach this stuff all the time. You speak up about it all the time. Why don't you write a song about it and start talking about it? And I had a couple of other elders suggest similar things. And I thought, okay, well, it seems the universe has given me the signal to challenge this, you know, to do this. And it made me very nervous. And I thought, well, that's a good sign. It means it's important to you. So crafting it took some time, and the rest of this EP is very confronting. Every single track is not necessarily always from a purist Aboriginal perspective. There's other topics discussed. You know, a single coming in the near future talks to a hate crime of a friend of mine that is a gay man that was viciously assaulted in a hate crime by two straight men for no other reason than his orientation. You know, they went, quote unquote, as the news article reported the hate crime, gay hunting. And my friend, who is incredibly resilient, forgave these two men and actually advocated that they wouldn't serve jail time. And they were facing 15 years under Victoria's hate crime laws. Another song's about a friend of mine who's an Afghan war veteran who returned home and wasn't adequately supported by the Department of Veterans Affairs and the RSL. And sadly, you know, he would later join a motorcycle club and later take his own life. And, you know, we've lost more veterans here on our own soil after returning from combat than we've lost in some of those conflicts, such as Afghanistan. We're actually losing these boys here. And, you know, another song, just to give you a sense of this EP, is another song, again, is about the colonial takeover of Australia, the invasion, and its linkages to native title and to mining industries and sort of these songs I chose were all very challenging songs. They were all about people that were incredibly resilient, about our common sense of humanity, about voices that don't get heard enough, that sort of, whether they're veterans, whether they're marginalized groups from the LGBTQIA+ community, our broader queer community, whether they're Aboriginal specific resistance stories. But I wanted to share these stories because I felt I respected the struggle. I respected the struggle that everyone in these groups was going through, and the resilience and the humanity of each of these people to try and overcome these obstacles. And they were all quite dark and heavy subjects and had to be done in a way that was specific to the story. And the only thing I kept coming back to is I had to be very honest and very specific and clear, and at the same time create lots of imagery so people could play the story in their mind's eye, so they could empathize with the main characters in these stories. But they're all based on real stories. That, you know, they're either in quite heavily inspired by a real story, or they're verbatim the real story of what occurred in many cases. You know, and Uncle Archie Roach as well. I was down there on Framlingham with one of the elders down there, and we were in old Uncle Banjo's house, and Uncle Lenny was an elder down there, and he was telling me how Uncle Archie came up with the story they took the children away. And, you know, there were literal quotes Archie used from Uncle Banjo reciting the story, because Uncle Archie was so young when he was taken away there were parts he couldn't quite remember, and Uncle Banjo remembered all of it. He was there that day. And so he ended up using the quotes, like the quite specific parts of that song came from what Uncle Banjo had told him. And so in a similar way, it just comes back to, I don't need to tell people how to feel. I just have to tell the story, and they naturally, you know, will connect because it's the human experience, you know, regardless of where you're from or what's occurred. You can't help, if you're a normal, healthy human being, but empathize with another human being having an incredible struggle, whether that's an Afghan war veteran, whether it's a young man being brutally assaulted because of his orientation, or whether it's an Aboriginal baby surviving a massacre despite the odds. And telling those stories just felt, they're very Australian stories. They're specific to Australia. And that, you know, that to me was really important. And I just chose these stories that grabbed my heart, many of them on this EP are Aboriginal specific stories, but equally many are stories for everyone. They're broader than that. They're just those marginalized groups that haven't had the chance to speak up. And I wanted to give my platform to those groups and either be a staunch ally just say, look, I'm here. I'm standing next to you. I'm here. I'm not going to leave you on your own.
Just in wrapping up, how can people sort of follow your platform, and where can they go to sort of listen to your music but follow you on social media to get to know a bit more about yourself and also where to find your music?
Well, if you are looking for music, you can jump on Spotify and type in Chasing Ghosts Summer, and you'll immediately find myself and the band. If you're, you can also go on Apple Music, and any place that you find good music, you'll be able to find Chasing Ghosts. YouTube, of course, Chasing Ghosts. Once again, you can find Summer on there, any good retailer, you'll be able to access Chasing Ghosts. On Spotify, on social media, you can jump on Instagram, and again, it's just at Chasing Ghosts. Facebook. Also there and available, and get in contact, come out to a show, say g'day. So anyone should be able to find us. If you can't, then please contact us on Instagram and follow along our story as we continue to share, you know, really good stories about what's occurred in our country.
Deadly, thanks, our brother. It's been a pleasure to have you on the program this morning. Right. And if you're just tuning into Let's Talk, just before we wrap up, I have been chatting with Jimmy Kyle from Chasing Ghost. We've been chatting about our conversation initially kicked off because of our love of history and also First Nations resistance. And brother has an amazing song called Summer. Please check it out. It's out now on all platforms, as he said, and check him out on social media as well. If you've enjoyed the program, you can catch the repeat at 7 p.m. tonight or go to our website at 989fm.com.au and follow the links to the podcast. You can also stream us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And as always, it's a pleasure. You've been listening to Let's Talk on Murray Country 989FM.